Welcome to Clinical Conversations, a Journal Watch podcast for the week ending July 9th. This is podcast number 95. I'm Joe Elia. Our interview comes first, and then we'll have a look at the week's clinical news. You're listening to Clinical Conversations. Lancet released a study this week examining whether patients with uncontrolled hypertension might manage the conditions themselves, as, for instance, diabetics do. The researchers randomized about 500 people either to self-management, according to an agreed-upon protocol of changes to medication based on blood pressure targets, or to usual care, according to British national guidelines. Pressures in the intervention group were also monitored remotely by clinicians. By the end of the 12-month study, intervention patients showed a more than 5 millimeters of mercury greater drop in systolic pressure than did the controls. An editorialist noted that the study's results could profoundly affect the way we treat patients with uncomplicated hypertension. That editorialist, Dr. Benga Ogedegbe, has agreed to chat with us. Dr. Ogedegbe is an associate professor of medicine and the director of the Center for Healthful Behavior Change in the Division of General Internal Medicine at New York University School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Ogedegbe.
Thank you.
That study, interesting editorial. Thank you. Thank you for putting it into perspective for the readers. It was it helped me as I was trying to figure out how to cover this story for Physicians First Watch. That study was conducted in England. And how well do you think the results would translate to the United States?
That's a very good question. To the extent that the patient population that people, then it does translate. The extent that the study was conducted in general practitioners' offices, which we'll call here family practitioners or internists, then it does translate. The lack of generalizability has to do more with the poor participation of minority patients. So we don't have blacks in those studies. We don't have Latinos. And we don't have, frankly, other minority groups in the study. So it's difficult to translate to that population.
And those patients who were in the intervention group all had blood pressure monitors that were plugged into their telephone systems. And I'm wondering whether that kind of technology might be available here in the groups that you were just talking about.
It's actually available. We conducted a study between 2001 and 2008 in about 12 primary care practices, community health centers, they call them, in the U.S., in New York City, where we used similar technology. So the technology has been around, and, you know, people have phones at home, penetration of 95% in the U.S. So the technology has been around for a long time. What is new is that this technology has been taken to the next level, where you can actually have people wirelessly send their blood pressure readings to the office. So you don't need telephone lines anymore to make this happen. Although that is new in the past 2-3 years, that's out there. So it's easily doable here as well.
Well, that's good, because most people nowadays have cell phones instead of the other phones. As you say in the editorial, we're used to people titrating their own diabetes and asthma medications, and it makes you wonder why it hadn't been thought of before in hypertension.
It actually hasn't. There were two small studies that came out. One of them was, I believe, in 1997 or 2007. I can't quite collect the date. I think it's more 2007, where they looked at a similar study, but it was done in a very small sample size, about 100 people, where people were followed pre and post. It wasn't a randomized trial, so we don't know how much of what they found in that study was due to chance. The reason it's not been done also may be because the home blood pressure monitors were not that popular 10 years ago. Now, according to a Gallup poll that came out in 2005, the use of home blood pressure monitoring at home is about 75%. So the penetration of home BP monitoring is much more advanced. And really, 10 years ago, we didn't have this kind of technology. So I think those two factors actually make the availability of this kind of programs much more flexible today.
You mentioned in the editorial that the authors of the study are conducting a cost-effectiveness analysis that they haven't published yet. Are you anxious to see those results?
Absolutely. That's the thing that I feel would give anybody a pause, especially policymakers. You really want to see how much are you saving with this kind of technology. Because while we think it's convenient, while we think it may reduce, what you might call it, the patient visits to the clinics, it's not clear that we're going to be saving any more money. So they have that data, which they promised to publish in a separate paper. I'm anxiously waiting for that. It will make a big difference, because if we show that this is cost-effective, then it's easy to make the argument for health insurance companies to pay for home blood pressure monitoring, which at the present is not uniform in the U.S. I believe in the U.K. it's not that uniform in terms of payment as well.
Uh-huh. And, you know, the intervention patients ended up taking slightly, on average, more drugs than the usual care patients. I wonder why that happened.
So remember, the intervention itself is really to promote self-titration of medication. Mm-hmm. So the intervention patients, they tend to monitor their blood pressure much more than patients in the control arm. So if I'm monitoring my blood pressure and I see that the reading is high, I'm able to titrate my medication. So that is the intervention. That's the proof of the intervention. So nice. The fact that they're monitoring it more just means that they're engaged much more in their own care. That's what we're trying to see. Now, does that translate to better blood pressure control? That's what we find out. It turns out it did translate to BP control. So that's what we want to see, which is good. The other thing I didn't say in the editorial, which I think is crucial also, is if you look at the way we take care of patients, there's a concept that we call clinical inertia. In other words, docs are not as aggressive as they should be in titrating patient medications. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem in this case, because the patients have been given the freedom to do that themselves, of course, with guidelines. So that this intervention actually also addresses that problem, although it's kind of indirectly, but it does address it.
So the problem of clinical inertia, as you call it, huh?
Right.
Huh. As opposed to patient inertia, because now the patients have been trained to have a role in their care.
Exactly.
Is that drop, it's about 5 millimeters of mercury, a difference between the two interventions. I'm not a clinician. That is something that clinicians would like to see. Is that clinically significant?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it turns out, if you look at the drug trials, that's where we give people medications and we compare one medication to the other. It turns out, if you look at those studies, over 5 years, or 4 to 5 years, a drop of 4 to 5 millimeters of mercury, a difference between a control and an active arm, leads to significant reduction in mortality and significant improvement of prevention of complications like heart attacks, strokes, and kidney disease. So if that 5 millimeter difference is sustained over time, that is a big deal. If you reduce blood pressure by about 5 to 10 millimeters of mercury for a period of about 10 years, you only have to treat 11 people to prevent one death. Oh. So that's a big deal in our mind. This is sustained over time. It's really a great drop in blood pressure.
That is a
typically
big deal.
We see anywhere from 2 to 3 millimeters of mercury when you use home blood pressure monitors, but this saw a much larger effect than that. So this is good.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to their cost effectiveness analysis, and I hope that if it's published in Lancet, they'll recruit you to write the editorial.
That would be fantastic. I look forward to it too. Anxiously, for that matter.
All right, Dr. Ogedekbe, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Here's a summary of the week's clinical news. You may be hearing more about a U.S. Veterans Administration decision to make collecting compensation for post-traumatic stress disorder easier. Not that qualifying for it was a walk in the park. Veterans of any U.S. war now only have to show that their situation put them in harm's way, and they won't have to specify the experience that's causing the PTSD. VA clinicians get to make the final determination, however. Next, glucosamine, widely used for low back pain, doesn't do anything that a matching placebo can't, according to a study in 250 patients randomized to receive one or the other. Pain scores dropped in both groups under treatment, but the glucosamine recipients' scores dropped about the same as those on placebo. Finally, diabetics with coronary artery disease who are treated with tight blood pressure control, that is, below 130 systolic, don't have better outcomes on a composite measure that includes all-cause mortality, myocardial infarction, and stroke. The study was conducted in 6,400 adult diabetics with CAD. Well, that's it for this week. Let me know what you think. My email address is jelia, J-E-L-I-A, at jwatch.org. Or you can leave a voicemail at 1-617-440-4374. Earlier podcasts are available at podcasts.jwatch.org. The Journal Watch website is jwatch.org, where you'll find almost 25 years of summaries of the most clinically useful research. It's a great resource in an ever-changing clinical landscape. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Adore Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Join us next time, and thanks for listening.